Out single for Ruthie Steinman keeps the inning alive for Medford. And that will bring up Jolie Steliga, the extra hitter. Here's Majeski's pitch. Fastball drops just a shade down low for ball one. Again, our next broadcast with Wausau Post 10 will be next Wednesday night against D.C. Everest Post 492. 620 airtime here on 98.9 WXCO. There's a foul ball. So again, next week, Wausau Post 10 has a road game at Crandon on Tuesday, and then we'll be back with them at Wausau East High School next Wednesday against D.C. Everest. Again, 6:30 first pitch, 6:20 airtime here on 98.9 WXCO. The 1-1 rises up and out of the strike zone. Two balls and one strike. Runner on first and two outs. Majeski's pitch. Ground ball pulled foul, third base side. And that will even things up at 2-2. Two balls, two strikes, two outs. Majeski's pitch. Popped up over the backstop and out of play. We'll do it again at 2-2. Well, it's turned into a very comfortable evening. Basically no wind at all right now. Kalen Majeski's pitch. There's a pop-up, short left field, going back, and the running grab is made. Nice job at shortstop there, getting the grab as Taylor Defner for Wausau to end the top of the seventh inning. No runs on one base hit. There were no errors, and one runner left on base. Heading to the bottom of the seventh, it is 11-4 Medford over Wausau. This is Wausau Post 10 American Legion Softball on 98.9 WXCO, online at WXCO.fm, mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO, and on the Civic Media app.
Shifts in the market don't need to disrupt your long-term financial goals. Hi, I'm Peter Gunn, an Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Let's work together on an investment strategy for long-term results. While you can't control market volatility, you can control your financial future. Start by giving me a call at 715-849-5258 or emailing at peter.gunn@edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau, streaming at bullfallsradio.com.
And Nora Hintz will lead things off for Wausau Post 10 in the bottom of the seventh inning. Wausau trails Medford 11-4. Here is the pitch. Fastball in there for strike one called. Nothing and one. Nora Hintz, and then the top of the order, Kalen Majeski and Baylen Holstrom for Wausau. And the pitch. Swing and a miss. That's strike two. Nora Hintz is 0-1 tonight. Right-handed batter, slightly open stance, hands up high. 0-2. Bounces in there, goes to the backstop, and that's ball one. Again, if you missed this broadcast or any of our play-by-play broadcasts of high school athletics, you can get them as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. Also go to our website, go to the show's page, go to the bottom, and look for WXCO Sports. Pitch is up high and out of the zone for ball two, 2-2. Again, search WXCO Sports on your favorite podcast hosting site to get our previous broadcast. 2-2. There's a fly ball center field. Can of corn coming in, squeezing for out number one. And out in center field right now for Medford is Finley Arndt, as she's been all night. Oh, he's holding the breath. Maybe he made one of those changes. But now it will be Kaylin Majewski stepping in. Pulls it back after squaring the bunt. Pitches up high for ball one. Thanks to our sponsors of our Wausau Post 10 coverage, including American Family Insurance, Jamie Schley Agency. 1-0. Misses outside for a ball. 2-0. Featherstone Cabinetry, Priceless Building Center, and Edward Jones Investments, Peter Gunn. All those terrific supporters to bring you this action here tonight. And five more times at least during the course of the season. Up and out of the zone. 3-0. 3-0 on Kaylin Majewski with Baylen Holstrom in the on-deck circle for Wausau. Left-handed batter. Open stance, waits. Pitches in there for strike one called. Fastball from Kaylin Hanel. Three balls and a strike. Here's the pitch. There's a ground ball towards shortstop. Picked there by Baumgartner. Fires across in time. Just beating the hustling Kaylin Majewski by about a quarter of a step. 6-3 on the putout. Two outs now for Wausau. And Baylen Holstrom up next. Right-handed batter waits. Here's the pitch. Catches the inside corner for strike one called. Baylen Holstrom has a single, has also walked and scored a run. Here's the rock and the 0-1. There's a roller foul third base side. No balls and two strikes. Trying to keep it alive for Wausau is Holstrom. She waits. Hanel to the plate. Strike three on the outside corner, and that will do it. Three up and three down for Wausau in the seventh, and Medford wins this season opener over Wausau by a score of 11-4. We'll come back and recap this one coming up next. This is American Legion Softball on 98.9 WXCO.
Hi, Jamie Schley here, agent with American Family Insurance. Do you know what it takes to make homeownership dreams a reality? American Family Insurance employees and agency owners and their local communities too. That's why I'm proud to support American Family's work with Habitat for Humanity. Just another reason why life's better when you're under our roof.
Contact Jamie Schley, agent at Jamie Schley Agency, LLC at 715-359-2400 today.
American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Chad Holmes back here from Sunnyvale Softball Complex, where the entire squads, both Medford and Wausau, getting together for a special picture here on this opening night celebration for the start of the American Legion softball season. And tonight it is Medford defeating Wausau by a score of 11-4. Big evening for Riley Robbie, the starting pitcher for Medford. She pitched the first four innings, and she was nearly flawless as she was able to mow down 3, 5, 7, 8, 9 batters. 9 Ks in 4 innings, and she is the winning pitcher. It was a one-run inning in the first for Medford, an RBI double by Riley Robbie to make it 1-0. Then 3 runs were scored in the second inning. The big hit was a 2 RBI hit with 2 outs from Finley Arndt to make it 4-0. Wausau scored in the bottom of the second inning. Peyton Kalmus had a one-out single, stole second, stole third, and on that steal of third, the throw went into the outfield for an error, and Kalmus came in to score to make it 4-1. Then it was a three-run top of the fifth inning for Medford. Two RBI single by Riley Robbie and an RBI single by Laney Robbie made it 7-1. Then Wausau would score three times in the bottom half of the fifth inning. RBI hit by Madison Krause in that frame, and also an error allowed a run to score as well. And actually, an error allowed a couple of runs to score in that inning to make it 7-4. Then in the top of the sixth, the four more runs came across for Medford. Included was an RBI hit by Riley Robbie and a two RBI hit by Zalia Leonard and an RBI ground ball by Laney Robbie to make it 11-4, and that would be the final score. 11-4 Medford over Wausau here in this season opener. Again, we will be bringing you five more games during the regular season when it comes to Wausau Post 10 American Legion softball. Our next broadcast will be next Wednesday night at Wausau East High School, where Wausau will take on D.C. Everest Post 492. So Post 10, Wausau against Post 492, D.C. Everest, next week Wednesday, 6:20 airtime, 6:30 first pitch, right here on 98.9 WXCO. But here tonight from Sunnyvale, it is Medford 11 and Wausau 4. Thanks to our sponsors, without whose help we cannot bring you this Post 10 American Legion softball game, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Chad Holmes. Hope you can join us again next Wednesday for more Post 10 softball here on 98.9 WXCO. This has been Wausau Post 10 American Legion softball on 98.9 WXCO. Online at WXCO.FM. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Wausau Post 10 softball has been brought to you by American Family Insurance, Jamie Schley Agency, Featherstone Cabinetry, Price Less Building Center, Edward Jones Investments, Peter Gunn Agent. Thanks for joining us for Wausau Post 10 American Legion softball on Central Wisconsin's radio voice for play-by-play, 98.9 WXCO.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So quickly approaching is the review of the USMCA, of which I understand all three countries want some renegotiation. And the weird thing is I thought we fixed NAFTA. I thought this was Trump's baby. The USMCA was the replacement of NAFTA. I thought this was the greatest trade deal ever. Everyone was happy. Kumbaya was sung. It was a brilliant renegotiation. And, we got everything we want. And there were sunshine and rainbows. And you know how Trump works. So we'll see. That's why I've asked my good friend Arthur Stamoulos to come share some thoughts on the upcoming review. Arthur is the executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. You can check out their website, citizenstrade.org. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So what's going on? Walk me through this process. We got a review coming up. A lot of stories I've read. Mexico's eager to get into the middle of this because of, I guess they've had some falling investments and the Trump tariff craziness. So what's happening and what should we know?
Yeah, so folks may recall U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement was Trump's renegotiated version of NAFTA during his first term in office. And as you said, he promised that the USMCA was going to bring jobs pouring back into the United States, that it was going to be especially great for our farmers, that it was going to have all these concrete benefits for working families across the United States. We're now 5 years into the USMCA, and our trade deficit is up relative to NAFTA. Companies continue to ship jobs to Mexico to take advantage of abysmally low wages, ongoing labor rights abuses, lax pollution controls. And there's all sorts of other ongoing goodies for corporations in the USMCA that undermine public interest policies in all three countries. The one good thing, or one of the good things about the USMCA relative to NAFTA, is that it has this built-in required mandatory six-year review, where the countries come together and can consider changes to the pact. And we're saying, hey, let's take advantage of that to get some real changes to this so that, you know, all the promises, all the wonderful things we heard this pact is going to do for working people might finally start to happen.
And by us, you mean you guys at Citizens Trade and the more than 600 organizations that have signed on and people like me who have signed on to your campaign. Is that what we're talking about?
That's right. We've got over 600 labor and civil society groups across the country, you know, outlining the changes to the USMCA that need to be made for this to actually deliver some benefits to working families and communities, not just in our country, but in all three countries.
Because, you know, I got to be honest, I'm expecting Donald Trump to come out and hold to, it's the greatest deal ever. We don't need to do anything. So I guess the question is, has the USMCA had any real effect on job security or wages for American workers? Has it benefited us in any way that you can point to?
No, we've seen the trade deficit continue to rise. And again, more and more jobs continue to be offshored. I mean, virtually every week. And so one of the big things that we're calling for, and that, as you mentioned, over 600 groups are calling for, is to address some of the reasons why companies move jobs primarily to Mexico. And that's, again, to take advantage of the ongoing labor rights violations, the lax pollution controls, the piss poor wages. So let's have much stronger labor and environmental standards. Let's make sure they're backed up by much stronger enforcement mechanisms so that they're not just on paper, they're actually enforced, and that unions and environmental groups and other individuals have an opportunity to use them. We're not relying on whoever's in the White House to enforce them for us. And let's make sure that there are actually direct wage increases in the USMCA as well. Right. You know, if you look at NAFTA, wages, real wages went down over the entire course of NAFTA's 30-plus year history. It wasn't until very, very recently when President López Obrador was in Mexico that they finally raised the minimum wage and, you know, wages sort of blipped upwards a little bit. But they're still, you know, pennies on the dollar in comparison to what U.S. workers make.
Yeah.
And you can't have free trade when workers in one country are denied their basic rights and they're paid, you know, sweatshop wages. You know, no one can compete with that.
One of the selling points that I remember from the USMCA, especially from my labor friends, was that for the first time we've put labor standards in this, and independent unions are something that are now possible in Mexico. This whole idea that they're going to be like us, you know, was sold to us. Is that not the reality?
Yeah. So when Trump first renegotiated NAFTA, I mean, he basically just renamed it the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement, and he tried to bring it back his first term in office and get it through Congress. At that point, Democrats were the majority in the House, and so congressional Democrats, labor unions, faith groups, civil society groups were able to push at that point, you know, stronger labor standards, stronger labor enforcement mechanisms than we'd seen before. And of course, the Trump administration, their first time around, never used them to enforce labor rights, but the Biden administration did. And over 30,000 Mexican workers, you know, were able to use those new labor rights provisions to get stronger unions, to get stronger contracts, to replace some of the company unions with actual independent unions of their own choosing. So that's been great. We've supported that wholeheartedly. But 30,000 workers out of millions of workers who are under these protection unions in Mexico is not enough. And so we're saying, like, we need to strengthen the standards. We need to strengthen the enforcement provisions as well.
Now, you know, I listened to Donald Trump talk about, you know, wanting to bring manufacturing back, and I listened to the rhetoric, I listened to the talking points, I hear my Republican friends talking about how they seem to have found their way to caring about labor and caring about manufacturing. A lot of rhetoric, a lot of words, a lot of words. The action's completely different. So this may sound redundant, but I want to make sure that I hammer on the point that you know, Donald Trump's NAFTA, because this is now his baby. As you said, he renamed it, slapped his name all over it, fully endorsed it, had big press conferences, you know, said this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I just want to make sure that the flow of jobs not coming into the country, unfortunately going out and harming communities all across our country. I want to make sure that I've got this right.
That's 100% right. I mean, again, the trade deficit under the USMCA is worse than it was under NAFTA. We continue to be importing more than we're exporting. And, you know, if you look at an industry like autos in particular, that's gotten far, far worse under the USMCA relative to NAFTA. We're importing way more cars and car parts. But it's not just autos. I mean, it's aerospace, it's agriculture, it's all sorts of industries.
So let me ask you, you know, if you were me, I want to scrap the whole damn thing. To be honest, I want to do away with all of these horrible free trade agreements. I want to end permanent normal trade relations with China. I would do very radical things. But you guys at Citizens Trade, what changes would you like to see in this review process that would help protect workers' rights, to help ensure fair wages, to help raise living standards for not just, you know, Mexican workers, but American workers as well?
Yeah, so we want the labor and environmental standards, again, to be strengthened. We want them to be applied to all three countries. We want the enforcement mechanisms to be much better funded and strengthened and made in a way so that they become much more automatic, the enforcement, and not reliant on whoever's in the White House. We want there to be actual minimum wages in certain sectors before goods can enter the United States duty-free. We want to remove a lot of the corporate giveaways that were left over from the original NAFTA and that were added by Trump to the original NAFTA, particularly giveaways to the big tech sector that make it easier to offshore people's private data, you know, your banking information, your financial information, your public health information, your biometrics, your geolocation, all of that, which makes it easier for companies then to offshore the digital economy jobs that go along with that data. We want to remove the restrictions on AI regulations that big tech snuck into the deal, which would, you know, make it virtually impossible to regulate AI in the workplace and everywhere else. And, you know, if we can't get those types of changes, we agree with you, Rick, just scrap the deal, get rid of it. We think a good deal is better than no deal because trade is going to continue whether or not we have rules in place or not. We want good rules that privilege worker rights and environmental rights and human rights instead of corporate rights. But if we're not going to get that, yeah, you're right. Get rid of it. No deal is better than a bad deal.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where, as I was listening to you go through the line, and look, I agree with you. I would like to see a higher minimum wage, not just in Mexico, but here at home. I would like to see stronger enforcement, not just in Mexico, but here at home. I would like to see virtually everything that you outlined, not just in Mexico, but here at home. This administration has made it their mission to destroy all of the things that you laid out. So what are the chances that they would do this in Mexico when they refuse to do it here and are actually going the other way in destroying what we already have to kind of get us down to where Mexico is?
Yeah, no, it's not easy. And the question is, are they serious about rebuilding American manufacturing and creating an opportunity for good paying jobs in the United States, or are they not?
But don't you think those are two separate things?
I think it's easy to be cynical about that.
I am.
And I think there are some people in the administration who maybe are serious about that, and others who we know, hell no, aren't serious about that. And the question is, how big of a stink do we raise, and how do we hold their feet to the fire, and not just the administration, but Congress and all the rest of them, to get what we want, or, you know, as you said, scrap the whole thing. You know, it's not easy. I mean, these are ongoing fights. As you know, we've been having these fights for 30 years now, but, you know, I got to believe progress is possible, you know, if we're willing to hold elected officials accountable and see through a lot of the fluff and the con jobs that they try to push on us.
No, clearly. And, you know, you talk about manufacturing, and look, I do. When Donald Trump talks about reshoring manufacturing, I'm going to take him at his word, but there's the idea of bringing back manufacturing, And then there's the other part of it. I think the most important part, and you hit on it as well, that those have got to be good paying, you know, family sustaining wage. I argue union jobs with health care and retirement security and job security and all the things that come along with that. But those are in this administration, in my view, those are going to be mutually exclusive. They're going to want to bring back manufacturing, but they're going to want to bring back Mexico or even China's labor regime to make those jobs poverty jobs here at home, so we don't have to ship things so far.
No, that's right. I mean, the way that labor and, you know, other advocates were able to sort of sneak in the progress we did make during the first NAFTA renegotiation in terms of labor enforcement was saying, like, hey, you know, these abysmally low wages, these ongoing labor rights violations in Mexico undermine U.S. business here at home. These environmental abuses in Mexico and other countries undermine U.S. business here at home. And that's something that certain members of the administration were like, okay, we can get our heads around that. And if this is what it's going to take to get it through a Democratic-controlled Congress, we'll make some incremental progress in those areas. Whether we will be able to continue that is really going to depend on again, how hard people push. I mean, Trump is way out on a limb as the only guy with, you know, promising that he's going to revitalize American manufacturing and create jobs for American workers and, you know, quote unquote, make America great again. You know, we got to hold his feet to the fire on that promise and either get the advances that he's been promising all along or expose him as a con man. Either way, you know, we got to do that and do one of those things, or we're just going to see things, as you're suggesting, Rick, continue to get worse and worse, because you're right. He is no friend of organized labor, and, you know, no friend of the environment, obviously. And, you know, he's not going to do the right thing. I mean, if you look at who he's appointed to run his trade negotiations, the first term was a guy named Robert Lighthizer, who, you know, I didn't agree with on most things, but at least was legitimate about wanting to rebuild U.S. manufacturing.
Right.
The people he has running his his trade negotiations today are two literal Wall Street billionaires. Their background is not in manufacturing. Their background is in speculation and in gaming Wall Street. So we have our work cut out for us. We're not going in, you know, with rose-colored glasses here. But we know, you know, if we're not fighting for something better, we're going to get something worse.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, look, as I said, my preference is to get out of the whole thing altogether, because I don't think we're going to get a good deal. I don't think Mr. Art of the Deal, our con man, is any good at this. He has proven himself to be not very good at making good deals for American workers, for himself, for his family, for, you know, those in his inner circle. As long as you're loyal enough, he takes care of them. Average everyday working people, not so much. So given this review process, and then given all of the turmoil with the tariffs and the back and forth and all of the accusation, all that stuff, any chance that this doesn't get moved forward?
It's possible. The one thing about the USMCA deal, as opposed to all these other trade negotiations, is that the review and the renegotiation is required in the text of the USMCA agreement internationally, and it's required in the law that Congress passed to enact the USMCA. So, you know, Trump has shown himself as more than willing to ignore the law. But, you know, as trade policies go, this is the most likely one to actually be considered and to move forward and to have some process attached to it. Now, whether we're going to get, you know, just fluff and smoke and mirrors, or whether we're going to get actual change, or whether we're going to get out of the pact altogether, again, that depends on us as much as anything else.
Yeah, there's where the intrigue is. And then we didn't even talk about Canada, because, you know, Canada can't be thrilled either with, especially with, you know, they don't want to be the 51st state. They clearly don't want to play the tariff game. So I got to imagine this is going to be an interesting negotiation.
Yeah, no. I mean, they're rightfully pissed. I mean, can you imagine another country saying, hey, why don't you join our country? Your country is, you know, a BS country. It's insane. And people are angrier than I think a lot of Americans realize about that. But, you know, they're also very dependent on trade with the United States. They have business interests. They have, you know, labor interests in Canada who want to see some sort of deal continue. So, you know, there is reason for all three governments to sit down. And again, it's going to depend on how big of a spotlight we shine on this and how big of a fire we build under their feet to see, you know, if we get meaningful changes or not. And if we're not active, we're not going to get anything.
And how petulant our child is. I'm going to go with that as well. If you want more information, check out citizenstrade.org. That's the best place to go, right, Arthur?
Yep, that's the perfect spot.
Citizenstrade.org. We'll get links out. Arthur, I appreciate you taking some time. Keep up the great work. As this continues, love to have you back and keep us up to date.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Arthur Stamoulos, Executive Director there of Citizens Trade Campaign. Check out their website, citizentrade.org. Want to hear your thoughts. You with me? Out? Or, you know, status quo? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Occasional clouds for tonight and tomorrow. A slight chance of a sprinkle or shower. Lows of 50 to 55 and highs of 70 to 75. Some smoke also around. More rain possible Thursday night and Friday. Highs only 60 to 65. It's 65 right now.
Matt Nair on air.
State Representative Christian Phelps.
As somebody who's in my first term in the legislature, one of the striking things is how seldom the majority party speaks with us. I don't know how many of my colleagues personally feel LGBTQ people don't deserve freedom, but that's kind of irrelevant at the end of the day. They've already spent a number of days attacking trans people because those are days they don't have to spend defending their very unpopular economic agenda.
Matt Nair on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of responses over the last couple of days on Democrats finding their roots. And yesterday we talked with David Madeline from the Center for American Progress, and the response there was, yeah, of course, duh, we need stronger unions. Yeah, duh, we want tax policies that are going to be more progressive, to where the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry. There seemed to be a lot of agreement. Where the attacks came from were, you know, my assessment that the Democrats just haven't done a good enough job in messaging, and it's been kind of gotcha stuff. Which is why when I saw the Substack article by my next guest pointing out that, yeah, Madeline Dean got her viral moment, but was it really helpful in attracting working people? Did saying deficits, trade deficits don't matter, really, really hit the spot? And here to share some thoughts on his article and maybe where Democrats should be going and the messaging they should be using. I've asked Mike Lux to come talk with us. Mike is the originator of the Factory Towns Project. If you may remember, back in 2022, we traveled through many states in the Midwest talking about this very issue. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for inviting me on, Rick. Good to see you again.
So I'm glad you brought up the Madeline Dean thing, because I had a lot of people say, well, you see, look what she did. And I'm like, I don't know that really hit the mark. Bananas, we can't make those here. It was one of those trade issue things that rational people can discuss. Not sure it hit the right mark.
Yeah, you know, the problem wasn't with the banana line. You know, it was clever enough and funny and... it's certainly true. There are things that we need to trade for and with, you know, other countries.
Right.
The problem with what it was with the way she framed it and what she said going into her viral moment, which was, you know, trade deficits don't matter. It really doesn't matter, you know, what our country makes here or sells here basically sort of blowing off the whole idea of making things in America.
Right.
And that is a huge mistake for Democrats to pursue that. She was being clever. She was being funny. She got her viral moment. But what she said ahead of the viral moment was terrible.
It's the reason that Democrats have lost the working class. I mean, that one line to me, when I saw that, I'm like, yeah, no wonder.
Absolutely. You know, people are very confused about tariffs right now because Trump, you know, is Trump. He's a bull in a china shop. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's throwing out a tariff here, a tariff there. Then he rescinds it. And so people are very confused about what the hell tariffs are, right? But there is a, you know, regular working people understand that stuff needs to be made in America for us to have a good economy. They get that. That's like a core value to folks. I do a lot of polling. Making things in America is like right at the top of the list.
Absolutely, because those are our jobs.
These are our jobs. Exactly.
The banana thing is to me one of those issues that I talk about trade all the time. I'm not opposed to trade. I'm a big trade guy. We should be trading. The problem is what do we define as trading? Bananas are one of those things we should trade for. We really don't have the ability to produce as many as we need. That's something we trade for. The difference is what we're now calling trade is simply buying stuff from somewhere else that used to be made here, and I don't consider that trade.
No, of course it's not trade. What that is corporations outsourcing jobs to other countries where they can pay, you know, 25 cents an hour. They can pay, in some cases, nothing. You know, there's slave labor going on in China and other countries. They can have sweatshops with no regulations. So it's cheaper for them to make it over there and then sell it here. But that means American workers aren't getting those decent jobs.
Yeah.
And it means that our communities are hollowed out. And it means that we're in real trouble from a basic economic point of view, national security point of view. If we don't make anything here, we are. Can I swear on your show?
No, but we'll understand what you're saying because
we are in deep doo doo.
Yeah.
All right. To quote Nancy Pelosi, it's a real problem to have a hollowed out country where the economists like Larry Summers. We'll say, well, but we can trade accounting services and legal services and financial innovation. We can have financial innovation that we sell to other countries. But all of that is for rich people. And it really, Rick, you know this, it doesn't trickle down.
Nope.
It does not trickle down.
Their insatiable appetite for more is never satisfied. But you brought up tariffs, and it's one of those things that I've been taking a beating over, especially from my friends on the left. So the question I guess I have is, how can Democrats frame the message around trade and tariffs that will once again resonate with working people? Considering, look, you were a Bill Clinton guy. I blame Clinton for a lot of the problems that we have in this
as
moment.
You should.
I blame him a lot for the messaging coming out of it. The messaging of, yeah, we're going to lose those good factory union jobs and we'll replace them with you can get an education down the road kind of jobs without actually doing anything that make their lives better. How can in this moment Democrats take this issue? Because Trump's given them a wide open field. He's not doing anything but causing more chaos and problems.
Right.
How do Democrats frame this better?
Well, I think what we do is we say, look, Trump is the chaos guy. We're the folks who want to make a long-term investment in American workers. We want to have more apprenticeship programs. We want to we want to make more investments in getting factories started here in America, and we do want to have some tariffs where other countries are cheating us, right? If China is using slave labor to make products, we ought to have a tariff on the products that they're making with slave labor. So tariffs are appropriate in that kind of targeted sense, but we're not going to do it in a chaotic way. We're going to do it in a way where we're creating an industrial policy that makes sense for the long term.
Kind of like that the last guy did. Kind of, what was his name again? Joe Biden, that Biden guy.
And you know, Joe Biden did you know, a fair number of things wrong. But Joe Biden had the right idea in terms of industrial policy. He was investing in factories. He was putting tariffs on where they needed to go on. He was stopping the sale of U.S. steel. I mean, he was doing things that were thoughtful, that were planned, and he was building infrastructure to allow factories to take goods to market. I mean, he was doing those things that you do when you're thinking things through for the long run. Now, that doesn't pay off in 4 years. People didn't see what was going on, didn't see it happening, and there was all of the other stuff, right? But that's the path that we need to get back to.
And they do a really crummy job, Mike.
And as Americans, by the way.
They do a really crummy job, Mike, of messaging. Look, the Biden infrastructure bill was kind of a big freaking deal. You know, just up the road from me, there's a Susquehanna River Bridge being built. And there was never a sign up there that said, brought to you by Joe Biden. Right. There's one up there right now saying, brought to you by Donald Trump, the bill that Biden signed as the money coming out of it. He had no problem putting his name on that sign.
No, our messaging operation sucks. And here's the thing, Rick, and I'm in a lot of these conversations here in D.C. The Biden folks would not promote their most popular initiatives and policies because they were scared that the donors would stop writing checks. Simple as that. I would say like this. Look, I just did a poll. This poll is at 80%. This poll is at 85%. This is popular stuff. Why aren't you pushing it? It's like, well, but the tech guys don't want us to really talk about that stuff, or the Wall Street guys, that makes them nervous. It's like, but we're talking. We got to get voters, right? We can raise money, but we got to get voters, and that was what they messed up on, and that is the crux of the problem with the Democratic Party.
As where I was saying, they should have done like Josh Shapiro did when the bridge burnt there in Philadelphia. Have a constant camera there, be promoting it, have events around. Hey, Kate, check a look at the camera. I was saying, you know, take that stupid sticker that people were putting on gas pumps saying, yo, Joe Biden did this. Make that 20 feet high and put it out there pointing at the rug going, Joe Biden did this. Because Democrats look, my labor friends are the same way. They don't seem to want to take credit for their victories. They'll eat the losses, but they won't take credit for the things that they do right. And that's just bizarre to me, man.
It's insane. It's insane. It's like, oh, we passed that bill. Great. Let's move on. Let's talk about the next thing.
So what strategies would you suggest? You're a strategic guy. What strategies do you suggest Democrats prioritize to attempt to effectively connect with working class voters to say, hey, look, we got your back. We've got your best economic interests at heart.
So first of all, right now, I would focus a lot, and this isn't going to surprise you, Rick. I would focus a lot on health care. Health care is an issue where voters actually trust Democrats more than they trust Republicans. And Republicans are wanting to do major damage to regular folks' health care, everybody's talking about Medicaid, and that's important. But Medicaid, Medicare is on the line. They're talking about cutting $500 billion in Medicare if this bill ends up passing. They're openly talking about it. They're talking about VA health care. They're talking about cutting out subsidies for the ACA. And they're also, you know, letting the insurance companies get away with murder. So I would start with healthcare. It is a bottom line, really important issue. But the second thing I would do is I would say, look, we are going to make a long-term investment in rebuilding manufacturing in this country. That is a core issue. We have let too many jobs go overseas. We need to change that. We need to turn that around. And the third thing I would talk about economically is I would talk about breaking up big monopolies. You know, it is amazing how much people know that this is a monopolistic system. They know the word monopoly. They know the word oligarchy. They know these words. And people are always surprised, like, you know, my Democratic political. Well, they regular folks don't know those words. They actually do.
Yeah, they do.
They know what's going on. They know they're being squeezed by these another swear word. These folks at the top, they know that in order for small businesses to compete, in order for unions to have more power, we have to break up these big companies. So that's the third big thing I would talk about.
Well, I mean, competition. I mean, you know, my Republican friends all believe in it, except where policy meets the road. And then right. Then we're not on the competition bandwagon. For me, competition is going to bring back those small businesses, going to give you the opportunity to take on all of these big special interests. But also, you know, I got to throw the tax code in there. We got to dig up Dwight David Eisenhower. We got to do something to return to a much higher top marginal tax rate and use those resources absolutely. In a much better way to do the things that you said, infrastructure, healthcare, education, all of that stuff. And yet I'm just not hearing the Democrats. It's all there. It's a smorgasbord of opportunity. And well, we're you know, saying trade deficits don't matter. So I guess the question I have is, how do Democrats take this stuff that you've laid out so expertly? How do they take this, use it, but don't fall into the "I need that viral moment" kind of hiccup? How do they go about that?
Well, I actually think it's pretty easy. It's just a matter of the will to do it. The will to say, look. Yeah, I'm going to piss off some big tech donors. Yeah, I'm going to piss off some Wall Street donors and go ahead and go for it. And I would point to you like a Pennsylvania. I know you're a Pennsylvania guy, Rick. Chris DeLuzio, who's a congressman from close to Pittsburgh.
One of the few people getting the tariff issue right, in my view.
He totally gets the tariff issue. He totally gets manufacturing. And he talks about monopolies. He talks about taxing rich folks, and you don't have to put it in complicated language. You know, people get it, I would point to him. I would point to a guy like Chris Murphy, who's from one of the richest states in the country. But Chris is like going after it. Chris is like talking about taxing wealth. Chris is talking about taking on monopolies. There's nobody in the Senate right now better at talking about the monopolies issue than Chris Murphy. So there are some Democrats that's doing it. Elizabeth Warren's doing it. Bernie Sanders is doing it. There's a lot of good people doing it. But the Democratic Party as a whole needs to, A, get off their butt, and B, just like get some courage. Yeah. Rick, there's plenty of ways to raise money. There's plenty of people to raise money from. We don't have to be scared of these big donors. We can raise good money. Bernie raised more than Hillary in the 2016 campaign, raising it from people giving $5, $10 at a time. You can raise money even if you're talking about these issues, but you just have to have the guts.
Yeah, I think especially if you're talking about these issues, I think you can excite a working class into a vision. And I've been saying this for a very long time. Democrats need to get that vision of what the future is going to look like, because Donald Trump did this back in 15 and 16. And I've said this a million times. I'm sure the audience is tired of it. But, Trump sold that vision to my family, otherwise known as the basket of deplorables. He sold them on the idea that he was going to bring back Brook Park Avenue all of those jobs at the Ford and the Chevy plant and all the hundreds of feeder plants that fed into that, those union jobs that supported a family on one income. That's what my family heard and why they supported Trump. They believed that we were going to recreate the prosperity of a past era without all the unions and all the stuff that actually made that whole right. other discussion. But that's what they got. And for me, Democrats need to have that vision of what that future is going to look like. And that's where I think one of Joe Biden's biggest failures, he didn't get that message out.
Exactly. He didn't talk about the vision. He didn't talk about that big picture stuff. He was too focused on the little details. A friend of mine did an analysis of Trump's speeches in that 2016 campaign. He didn't give a single speech in that entire campaign without talking about trade. Not a single speech.
Because he talked to the heart of my family. Look, I grew up in Cleveland. I witnessed deindustrialization happen. All of those good union jobs went away. And again, I got to beat up on Bill Clinton a little bit. He didn't start it, but he signed his name to it. And so it's around his neck.
No, it is around his neck. And people, by the way, when we do focus groups in working class communities, NAFTA's a 33-year-old trade deal, 32-year-old trade deal. Everybody knows what NAFTA is. Everybody hates it, and they blame it for what happened to them. Everybody knows what the WTO is. These are not obscure issues to people. These are like core issues, core values to people, and they absolutely they blame Bill Clinton and they blame Barack Obama, and those guys deserve a big chunk of that blame. The irony is that three-fourths of the Democrats in Congress voted against that crap, but Bill Clinton didn't. Bill Clinton was for it. Bill Clinton was the one that pushed it through.
His name's on it, even as you pointed out. The majority of Democrats did vote against it, but he owned it. So I guess last question I've got for you. Any faith, any hope that Democrats are going to take what you're saying, what we've been saying here on the show, and pick this up and run with it? Or is it really we're just trying to get attention, get our viral moment, stay on the fringes? Any hope?
I always have hope, Rick. We're living through a very tough moment, but you think about Frederick Douglass, you think about Harriet Tubman, you think about Martin Luther King. You think about these folks. They had no legal rights. They had no legal rights. not a one. And they if they rose their head up, someone was going to shoot at them, literally. And they had hope. And so if those folks can have hope, you and I can have hope.
There you go. Mike,
we just got to keep working it.
I appreciate the time, Mike. Always good talking with you. Keep up the great work. I hope folks will check out the Factory Towns Project. You can go to AmericanFamilyVoices.org for more information on Mike Lux and the work that they do. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think this is the issue that resonates? Do you think, does it grab you? That's what I want to hear. Is this that issue that makes you go, yeah, I'd vote for somebody who'd fight for that? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that labor leader John L. Lewis died. Born to a Welsh-American coal mining family in Iowa, Lewis became the leading champion of industrial unionism in the 1930s. He served as president of the United Mine Workers of America from 1920 until 1960. He was the founder of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. The CIO split off from the American Federation of Labor with the aim of organizing the thousands of workers who powered the U.S. industrial machine. Some public officials and the media accused the CIO of being infiltrated with communism. In 1937, Lewis delivered a speech in Washington, D.C. to deny these claims. The speech captured Lewis's commitment and passion for industrial labor organizing. He declared, quote, "The workers of the nation were tired of waiting for corporate industry to right their economic wrongs, to alleviate their social agony, and to grant them their political rights. Despairing of fair treatment, they resolved to do something for themselves. They therefore have organized a new labor movement conceived within the principles of the National Bill of Rights and committed to the proposition that the workers are free to assemble in their own forms, voice their own grievances, declare their own hopes, and contract on even terms with modern industry for the sale of their only material possession, their labor." He went on to say, quote, "Under the banner of the Committee of Industrial Organization, American labor is on the march. Its objectives today are those it had in the beginning, to strive for the unionization of our unorganized millions of workers and for the acceptance of collective bargaining as a recognized American institution."
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
If only more Democrats would listen to the guys like Mike Lux. It's about those factory towns or those former factory towns. It's about those working people. It's about those kitchen tables. That's the conversation we should be having. And look, Trump and company, they have done a great job of selling a con. I know working people who actually believe that Donald Trump cares about them, that the Trump administration cares about their health and safety and their welfare and their families. And you try and explain, you go, no, what they're doing is they're rolling back all of those protections that have been paid for in blood. They're rolling those back. For instance, the Biden administration proposed a heat standard, a heat protection rule. That was a lifeline. It would have safeguarded 36 million workers, required employers to provide water, shade, rest during extreme heat, you know, basic stuff to keep thousands of heat-related injuries from happening and potentially deaths, you know, basic stuff, stuff that is not the law today. And now with Trump back in the office and his hand-picked OSHA guy, David Keeling, a former Amazon and UPS guy, these protections are likely not going to move forward. Keeling's former employers have faced hundreds of safety violations, many of them, oddly enough, heat-related. I'm sure you've noticed the UPS situation where the Teamsters are calling out UPS for agreeing to put air conditioning in their package trucks, but they haven't done it. And I said when they won that, it was going to take years. They were going to drag their feet for years before they got this in there, which is why you've got to put pressure on them. The reality is the Trump administration's all about corporate interests and dismantling those worker protections because they're burdensome. You got states like Texas and Florida that have already banned local efforts to protect outdoor workers. Yeah, this is what we've done. Those frontline, those who we used to call heroes, you know, the farm laborers, the construction workers, the warehouse people, you know, people who the heat standard is a life and death issue. Without federal standards, what you have are workers who are left at the mercy of their bosses and the weather. Because look, union density in this country, in the private sector, is only about 6%. It is right about where it was, where it was virtually illegal to be a union member. So saying, well, you know, we should just join and form unions, and that's where I'm at. Every worker should be in a union, especially these folks who are literally dying on the job. Don't care. Now, what we do know is those heat-related jobs, those are mostly immigrant workers, older workers, people of color, people, you know, people at the bottom end of the spectrum who don't have the power to stand up and fight back. And this is what they plan on. So as climate change worsens, this threat is going to get much worse. And look, as Trump is throwing immigrants out of the country, the people who do these low-wage, physical, manual labor, outdoor, heat-related jobs, they're going to fall on either older workers who don't have options or really young workers who don't know how to stand up and advocate for themselves. The reality is, for me anyway, the message is clear. You got to organize, unionize, and demand those workplace safety measures in the workplace because we're not getting anything from our federal government. Labor is going to continue to be exploited. Our safety is going to continue to be ignored for the sake of profit because that's who these folks are. This is what they do. And the sad reality is we're still hearing the bloviating about how, you know, Trump cares about working people. Don't tell me what you believe. Show me what you're doing. And what this administration is doing is making working people's lives less safe, less prosperous, and more exploitable. Seems simple to me. This is why pay attention. Pay attention to what they do. I don't care what they say. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You will find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app. This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The U.S. is paring down staffing levels at U.S. embassies in the Middle East. President Trump added,
they are being moved out because it could be a dangerous place, and we'll see what happens.
CBS News has learned that part of the reason for the leave advisories is that U.S. officials have been told Israel is fully ready to launch an operation into Iran. CBS's Linda Kenyon also reports,
citing the potential for regional unrest, the State Department has ordered non-essential personnel at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, along with their families, to leave. The embassy was already operating under limited staffing, so the order will not affect a large number of people. At the same time, though, non-essential personnel and family members have been urged to leave Bahrain and Kuwait. Tensions have been growing in the region amid talks between the U.S. and Iran over its nuclear program. Those talks seem to have reached an impasse. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
Coming up.